Think of all the books that have shaped who you are. Now, let's advance the conversation. In this podcast, I'll dig into topics that affect how you see the world by talking with authors who write about them. This is Cap Radio Reads. I'm Donna Appadone. Today, you'll hear my conversation with Abigail Dillon, president of Earth Justice and essayist in the anthology All We Can Save. The world is in a climate emergency. That isn't just trendy lingo. It's the term accepted by Scientific American and its peer publications in other countries. It describes the status of decay of our interconnected web of environmental concerns. All We Can Save addresses that web of concerns. Essays and poems from more than 60 women in an array of careers provide us with perspective and encouragement. They help us to see the breadth of the problem and our potential in the solution. Abigail Dillon has devoted her career to environmental law because she believes in her client. As the tagline for Earth Justice notes, "The Earth needs a good lawyer." I asked Dillon why it was so important that only women contributed to this anthology.
I hesitate because it is not only women who are feeling this way or whose voices need to be heard, not by any means. But I do think women's voices around the climate crisis and now, as you say, emergency have not been lifted up. It's very rare to see a woman on the nightly news quoted in a newspaper about energy, for instance. When I started working on climate, I'd often be the only woman in an entire regulatory system about whether we would be using fossil fuels or clean energy. But I have found that there are all these leaders who are driving very practical climate solutions on the ground who are women. They are not waiting until there's an international framework. They are not waiting until there is a federal legislative framework. They are just going and doing the work wherever they are. And I have always felt that their voices were not lifted up, present in many of the rooms where understanding is being created, decisions are being made. And for many women I know, there isn't an intellectual disconnect between climate change and climate solutions and the future of family, being a mother, being a sister or daughter. I think the women I know have, you know, I don't want to say this to a fault, but more women that I know have been comfortable talking about what climate means to them personally. And this has to get personal for all of us. We are not acting like we are in an emergency. And I think it's because people aren't taking this personally enough or even allowing themselves to. And maybe it's because they're looking around and seeing other people act as if we're not in an emergency. And I feel like many women I know have been able to break through that barrier and create a place of speaking what is too often unspoken.
The way it is spoken by a number of the contributors reminded me a little bit of going back to early feminist books, feminist mystique, and you know the early books where I have something to say and I'm really ticked off and I'm going to say it loudly. There is a little bit of that with some of the contributors, not with everyone, but it's also a book that was published, written and published just before, shortly before the 2020 election. Does that have something to do with the attitude? Has that shifted a little bit since the election?
Well, I think it has everything to do with the ferocity of the book. Its timeline was designed to ensure that these voices were heard and relevant in the most consequential election season, certainly of my lifetime. And I think, I'll just speak for myself, I felt maybe this is a platform to speak my truth in this make or break moment. And if I can influence one person to recognize the stakes of this election through what I see, it's just, it felt like such an important moment to have that microphone or that you know, amplifier. And I think, and when we were writing this essay, the sense of foreboding was so strong. The peril that we were facing was so acute that you sense that urgency. But I can't say that after the election, I feel any diminishment in that. I mean, if anything, we have some of the greatest climate champions of our lifetimes in the White House, in our federal agencies. We've had people run and win on climate in the Congress. President Biden and Vice President Harris were the first president and vice president ever to center climate and justice in a campaign, and they won on it. And yet, our politics are still our politics. And so I think all of us are still feeling desperate, ferocious, and certainly more hopeful than we were before the election, but equally afraid that we won't act at the scale that is required in the time frame that is required.
The time frame being now. The time now. Frame being very little time left.
Very little.
Before we talk about your specific entry, your essay in this anthology, I want to talk about somebody else's essay because of its newsworthiness. A woman named Sarah Miller wrote a fascinating piece in which she wanted to make a point about certain dangers in real estate. And she did that by pretending to be shopping for real estate, pretending to be shopping for a condo in Miami. She staged herself by going to visit various condos with various real estate agents. It's only been 2 weeks since a condo building, as we're recording this, 2 weeks ago today, that the condo building in Miami collapsed. And reading Sarah Miller's account was chilling because she talked about the real estate agents who either didn't know or didn't want to discuss the situation that was facing them. They told her over and over again, no, these condos are safe. They have pumps pumping out the water. They've raised the sidewalk. Everything's okay. One person did sort of admit that there was more to it than that, but she walked away from that experience writing that these people are clearly here to make money and they're going to tell me whatever I will believe. Aside from the tragedy, loss of life in Miami, and what we have learned in the last couple of weeks about that situation, as an attorney, what do you see going on in that community? What do other people need to be looking at about where they live?
Well, I think we all have to recognize that the past is no longer a guide for the future. And so I'll say something lawyerly, but this applies beyond the law. But in Miami, I think there will be litigation for years to come over whose fault it was that this building collapsed so tragically. And I think it will surface. People made wrong decisions, I'm sure, of it. But I also think about the foundation that that building is on top of, that Miami is built on. It's wetlands. The flow of water, our entire aquatic systems are changing with our climate. And so the ground beneath our feet is literally shifting. And our laws aren't built for that. What is the responsibility of an engineer? What is the responsibility of a city council? What is the responsibility of your insurance company? Should you make your own informed decisions whether you are in too much danger? Or do we need better science, a better reckoning with the environment that we are in now that deals with the world we live in now and that is changing so quickly? And I think it will have to change our laws and regulations. What is reasonable to accept as safe is changing underneath our feet. And so I can't think of anyone in Miami who's feeling confident about what their realtors told them. You know, I thinking about Sarah Miller, she's written this beautiful piece that's circulating widely now. I think she published it personally, but all the words about climate have been said. And she looks back on that piece. I don't know her. I'm just reading this beautiful essay that I recommend to everybody. But she looks back on that piece as being too blithe and you know, has had it with trying to create the clever story about climate, because she is living in California and knows that every single fire season, her own home is just as endangered as that real estate that she was investigating in Miami.
Which fits beautifully with my next question, because you live in California, I live in California. We have fires, we had an earthquake in the last hour. We have so much going on, and yet we live here. People in Miami know that they live near an ocean, yet they live there. Why have we chosen to so conveniently ignore our surroundings and the possibilities of our surroundings? It's a psychological question, but we have to look at it.
I think our society is built around separating us from the natural systems that support us and giving us the illusion, whether it's air conditioning or the cars we get around in. I think we have gotten so far afield from recognizing that we actually rely on natural systems that we can affect, but that we cannot control. And in losing that holistic relationship to other beings, species around the world, in losing that sense of how water works, how soil works, our connection to the land, our respect for the limits of the earth, everything in this country makes an assumption that our resources are infinite and just get your share without thinking about what is actually within the limits of the system that we now are charged with stewarding and restoring. You know, just from a legal perspective, all of our laws are about limiting the damage you do. And at this point, the damage is so systematic that our responsibility should be at this point about repair and regeneration. But we're not built that way. Property is sacred, and what you own, the law says it is yours to do with what you will, and go out and own more, no matter what your choices do to other people. And we're going to have to change that sense of entitlement. And if we don't do it quickly, we'll find that our property loses its value very quickly.
Your essay, your chapter in All We Can Save is titled Litigating in a Time of Crisis. It's 9.5 pages long, but it speaks volumes. And that's the case throughout this anthology. Most of the pieces are less than 10 pages, but say so much, especially when they're packaged as they are, one right after another. The opening line in this, watching climate change progress is like living in a dream where running is required, but the reflexes are gone. I've had that dream. A lot of people have had that dream. It's a kind of a famous dream that recurs for a lot of people. But explain why.
I would say for at least the last 10 years, I am by no means the only one. Millions of people have seen a clear pathway to changing the way we make and use energy and moving off of fossil fuels to renewables like wind and solar to generate our power, and then to use that clean power to electrify everything else, from our buildings to our transportation system to even our heavy industry. And if you could do that, you would solve 75% of our greenhouse gas emissions problem, and you would pave the way for the other solutions. So being able to see that path and to know that people could make a fortune on it, but to watch us fail to move it quickly enough, not because the technology is there, not because it's economically infeasible, but because we are habituated culturally and politically to operate one way. It's like that dream where you know you have to run and it will be disastrous if you don't, but you are stuck and standing still.
Yeah. You identify so many areas that are culprits in this, but two that really stand out: lazy fatalism and white privilege. Can you explain those a little bit?
Well, my thought in the book is, it's a question that I keep asking myself, and I think that, there's no one answer, but I think this may be part of an answer. Why are people in this very wealthy country unwilling to make a change? And if we, you know, if we had made it 20 years ago, there probably wouldn't be any bad economic consequences. I think at this point, the shift is going to be fast enough that we're going to have to be very careful about helping communities not be left behind in this transition. But why aren't we getting out and voting? Why aren't we insisting that our elected leaders save us from an emergency that requires collective action? None of us will ever be able to ride enough bikes or change enough light bulbs, right? This is a classic problem where political leaders need to lead. And yet you see people not getting out to vote. You see climate change being allowed to be sidelined or even as a hoax. And I wonder why that is. And I look at who is going out to vote and who is prioritizing climate. And it's predominantly Latinx and Black folks. And I think, what is wrong with white people? And I'm beginning to feel it's this sense, how wrong can things really go? I think there are a lot of white people who are letting history be the guide, and they feel that the privilege they have enjoyed, they will continue to enjoy into the future, and are not taking responsibility for securing the future. In my essay, I cite to, there's a lot of work that's been done at Yale that looks at these attitudes across racial demographics, across gender demographics, across generational demographics. And, you know, I was just sort of feeling this way. And then I got into the literature and felt that my hunch was well supported by the data.
We're in denial, or we're too proud, or
too comfortable.
Too comfortable.
We can't believe it's really going to change or be this bad. We can't really believe it will be this bad. It will be that bad in Bangladesh during the floods. It might be that bad in Santa Rosa, but I'm in Sacramento. I think in California, we're starting to understand.
But you're still hopeful.
What choice do we have? Right? I don't know if hopeful is the right word. I remain steadfast. I have no other choice but to try to shape a different future. I still believe it's possible. And what makes me excited about that possibility is we could solve so many other problems, right? I mean, the idea of creating a society that's more just, as well as one that is livable from a planetary standpoint, be incredible.
I know you grew up in a legal family, so going into law was probably something you thought about at a very early age. But what was the moment when you knew it had to be environmental law? What did you see that made you know that this was the area that you wanted to practice?
I just got so lucky. I went to UC Berkeley Law School, complete failure of imagination. I was just not feeling like I was making great choices, that I needed to go do something. And I did come from a lawyering family, and so that came naturally. And after my first couple years of law school, you know, your second summer is the big job that's supposed to set you up for what your real job will be when you leave. And I was just feeling kind of like, I'm not sure that I have made the right choice, but I was really enjoying some of the classes that I'd done that touched on the environment. Berkeley's always had a great program. And I just had the good fortune to meet my future boss, who took a chance on me and invited me to come to Bozeman, Montana for the summer and clerk for Earth Justice. And it changed my life. It you know, the impact that a few people can have in protecting this whole gorgeous world of ours that's sustaining us. It just, it hooked me. And all I wanted to do was to come back, and I was able to. And so I've spent my whole adult life basically working at Earth Justice.
Isn't that interesting? You recognize so early that just a few people can make a big difference, but the whole world hasn't really picked up on that concept yet, that we could all really make a difference. Earth Justice has the best tagline, because the earth needs a good lawyer. That's great. It's clever. It really gets to the point. But I'm thinking there must be cases that you don't want to get involved in at Earth Justice. How do you draw the line?
Tell me more. What's on your mind as sort of the cases that...
Do you accept every case that comes along? Or are there some that you just say, this is out of our arena? How do you make those decisions? Do you stick with corporations versus communities?
So we represent all of our clients for free. So, and we represent, it can never be for someone's economic interest. We're a nonprofit charity under the IRS rules. So we're, you know, one of the tests for us is this case going to serve the public interest? That's the first question. And then we ask ourselves, will this case create an environmental benefit or prevent a harm that standing alone represents a good use of our donors' money? That's, we, you know, operate a gigantic law firm completely on donations. So is this case going to achieve an environmental outcome, which is standing alone important? And then beyond that, does it create a precedent which starts changing the law? And I think one of the most important things about the kind of litigation we do, which is called impact litigation, is that it can raise up a lawsuit beyond what's happening in the courtroom into the courts of public opinion. And so I think particularly in the 4 years of the Trump administration, many people came to see correctly what I've been seeing for the last 20 years, that courts are often the first and the last line of defense against abuse. And our environmental laws are among the very strongest in the whole world, because anyone who is impacted can stand in the shoes of the federal government and enforce our strong laws against a polluting corporation, for instance. And we can sue our own government, which is something we should never take for granted. It's actually quite unusual to be able to take your own government to account for enforcing and following strong environmental laws.
It's interesting when you think about that concept, not necessarily even comparing this country to other countries in the world, but just stating that concept as you have. Not everyone gets to do that. And it is rather an interesting opportunity that we have. So there are cases that you take on knowing that you're not going to win them, but it's worth it because of the impact in the long run.
We usually think we've got a chance, almost always, and we have a pretty astonishing win rate. So, for instance, we filed over 130 cases against the Trump administration, and we've won 85% of them. They're not all litigated to completion yet. But I want to say how remarkable that is, because the courts, of course, defer to the government over someone like my client. So to be that successful is both a commendation for my wonderful colleagues who are still out there litigating, but it's also a reflection of how far afield our government has gone. But, you know, for instance, there was a very important case that the Supreme Court took up, not this term, but the last, that could have just burst an enormous hole through the Clean Water Act, which is one of our most bedrock popular laws. It protects clean drinking water. It protects wetlands. And we were so worried that the court had taken up this case. And we worried that we were just trying to limit the damage, but we won with seven justices on our side. So, you know, my view is that the courts provide a place to actually get the real facts out. Fake news doesn't apply in the courts. Money in politics doesn't corrupt a given case, one hopes. We will be facing more hostile courts. We should never take fair courts, judges who respect science, for granted. That should always be a voting issue. But I think the insulation of our federal judges who have lifetime appointments, and the adversarial process, which is designed to get at the truth, it allows us to be in a forum where facts actually matter. And when we have an emergency and the facts on our side and the laws on our side, we win even before judges who would not think of themselves by any means as environmentalists.
Well, that's enough reason right there to be very hopeful. Just the structure that we're dealing with has hope built into it. You say, I stand by the flawed but extraordinary laws passed in the 1970s. And that stood out to me, not for what the laws are, but for the fact that that was 50 years ago. And that the laws that went into place then are the ones that strike you as important more than any recent laws. What was it about that era that produced a better legal situation for us environmentally?
Well, the first thing to say is sadly, we have very few new laws, very few. And so what we saw in the 70s was this extraordinary era of legislating because we had gone so far letting polluters do whatever they wanted. And so you had the Cuyahoga River on fire in Ohio. You had a oil spill that ravaged the coast of Santa Barbara. You had smog days in New York, days at a time killing tens of thousands of people. You had Rachel Carson writing Silent Spring. You had coming out of the civil rights movement in the South, an incredible group of people making the case about how waste was disposed and who was suffering the burden, which of course were Black communities. So I think in the 70s, you were hitting a moment not unlike this one, where the society became aware of untenable social injustice. And the environmental dimensions of that were becoming too acute to ignore. And so you had a bipartisan reckoning in Congress, and you see Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, and many more passed between 1970 and 1973, also with the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and a bedrock requirement that the federal government actually consider the environmental implications of its decisions before making them, which was revolutionary. It doesn't determine a decision. It just says, think about the environment, look before you leap. And so I think those laws responded to an emergency. Those laws are incredible and I love them. They're a beautiful home, but they have to be renovated for the true emergency that we face now. And it's not only climate. That's one dimension of the way that we are over-extracting, exploiting our planet, but we are also facing an extinction emergency. And anyone who thinks you can lose a million species and have food security and water security is fooling themselves. So we have 10 years in which to completely reverse our trajectory, not only for greenhouse gas emissions and climate, but for protecting our natural systems in a way that will sustain us for the next 50 years. So I'm hoping that we will see law reform on a scale like we did in the 1970s.
You also say the future is likely to demand more of us than we know how to give. Is that a connection to what you just mentioned in terms of the timing and the universality of the problem? Or did you have something else in mind?
You know, I have an 8-year-old son, and I don't know what it will be like for him to be raising children when he's my age. I mean, the kind of generosity that we'll have for each other, how we'll have to help each other through disasters. I mean, everything that's made us safe and comfortable up till now is shifting in ways that put us in danger. And so we're going to have new laws, but we're also going to have to have a different sense of community and how we protect one another and everything that, you know, will determine the future for the next generations. And I don't know yet how to live in the world that has already changed so profoundly. And it will ask incredible things of us. I think we will will rise and inspire each other. But I don't know that we will. I hope enough of us will.
It's such an interesting timeline because obviously this decay and this destruction has been going on for many, many years. We didn't recognize it for a long time, but we certainly recognized enough in the early 70s for these seminal laws to go into effect, and we're still counting on them. But that was a long time ago. 10 years left. We have words like crisis. We have words like emergency, and we've all heard them. So are we burned out on the message? Is there something that we just have pushed aside intentionally that we don't want to know about? Do you have any indicators?
Well, I love the subtitle of All We Can Save. And I love the title too. And it comes out of a beautiful poem. But truth, courage, and solutions. And I think that is a wonderful triumvirate. We have to face the truth. It's hard to do that. It's hard to have courage or face the truth when you think there's nothing to be done. And if you think that's nothing to be done, I don't know what, you know, why go there? And so I think we don't talk enough about our agency and what we can insist upon and what the paths forward are. And that's what's so great about the book, is you start seeing that human ingenuity is, and there's so much work, you know, analogizing to the coronavirus. It was so shocking that we could get vaccines in place so quickly, not only invented, but tested. And it was because people knew this was going to happen. And so the work was very close, right? It's the same with climate. People have known, brilliant people have known that this is a real problem for 40, 50 years. And in the last 30 years, incredible amounts of work have been done, and more and more and more of the smartest people are putting their energy here. And so it's just important to recognize, and this book is a wonderful testament to it, we're not starting from zero in terms of the solutions. We just have to demand them. We have to have the courage to look at the situation, recognize the change is imperative, but also possible, and take the leap.
You mentioned very early on the politics, the recent administrations, and it is difficult to look at this topic and talk about it without recognizing some dramatic changes from Obama to Trump to Biden. And there is a different, depending on a person's perspective on politics, people might see it different ways. People might see the pros and cons differently. How will you measure, how should any of us measure the success of the Biden administration on this topic? How will we know if changes have been made that will improve the situation?
I think it's worth, for anyone who hasn't, looking at the Biden climate plan. It was an extraordinary document, completely unparalleled in the federal sphere for its ambition. And if you are really on track to getting to 100% clean power by 2030, getting to zero emissions transportation by 2035, and to full decarbonization, I know a wonky word, but carbon-free economy before mid-century, that's what the science is telling us we need. And so what I think we need to do is just keep checking whether the actions of the administration, and not just the federal government, this has to happen at the city level. I mean, I'm in New York City right now and the subways are flooding. So much because it's a crazy summer superstorm. So much of the work happens at the level of the city. Certainly we know that in Sacramento, where I'm from. But if we're really tracking to those goals, then these 4 years will have been well spent. Here is my biggest worry. The U.S. has become the biggest oil and gas producer in the world. I've spent my lifetime hearing about energy scarcity, you know, possibly achieving energy independence. That narrative has changed to energy dominance. It's very hard for us as a country to walk away from that and recognize we can't afford to burn all this oil and gas. And that you know, that isn't how we need to measure our wealth going forward. And so that's where I think you see that some real disparities, gigantic new pipelines being advanced and defended, Trump policy defended by this administration. So I think we're all going to have to push hard on the oil and gas front. But I have high hopes for clean energy because I think it really is economically there. It has arrived. And I think even the private sector is coming along. And I hope to see great corporate leadership. People's bottom lines depend upon a livable climate. So I hope we'll see a sea change there over the next 4 years on clean energy.
Another contributor to All We Can Say was Maggie Thomas, who wrote the article before her position in the Biden administration in the inner circle there. But certainly, I'm sure she was on the short list already at the time that she wrote this. And of course, she's writing from a policy perspective in this. It's an important perspective. And if she had not had that, this essay in All We Can Save, it would be something that we might know is there, but might not look at from her perspective. So it was a good thing. But I was interested in just one line out of her essay. Good climate policy must be rooted in a culture of listening. Mm. And it seems like that listening has been missing.
It's such a big problem. I think the impulse has been to have a sort of masters of the universe solution, you know, to have an international treaty, Kyoto, and then to think about a cap and trade program that lets the market take care of it. It will be one thing. It'll be one perfect policy that will just solve climate, and then we can get back to business. And the sort of arrogance of that and missing the ways that climate touches every single thing. And if it touches every single thing, it can never be a matter of dollars for carbon. It's going to have to happen in community. How will we reshape Sacramento, for instance, or New York City, where I am tonight, to contribute to a livable future? You can't make those decisions without being deeply embedded in community. So someone once told me years ago, I wish I could find him and credit him, but that climate solutions are like fractals. You know, what will save us globally is also what happens at the city scale. And there's nothing you could do at the scale of the city or the county that doesn't involve listening and being responsive to what people need and how they live.
There was an interesting couple of stories on NPR late June of this year, 2021, about housing in Cleveland. And the point was very clearly made in that series that if you ask the people in the housing situations what they can do to improve their situation, they came up with, it's not so much that we need to change our housing, but if you would just insulate some of the homes in our community, then that would help our income. That would help how we communicate with each other. That would help our heating bills. And so just that one answer, listening to the people who are living with the problem, but that requires that humility. That requires that reframing of the question. We hear so much right now in our world about we have to reframe the questions, but we also have to reframe our connections with each other. How do we do that on a personal level? Because we're not all in policy.
Well, I love your framing and I love the question. And I want to turn it back to you. I'll say something that's coming to mind, but I think we're going through a time. This doesn't just pertain to climate or to COVID-19. It certainly applies to the reckoning that we're having around racial injustice in the country. That we don't, we make assumptions and we speak for others. And I'm puzzling over who I mean by we. Who's the we I'm talking about? But I think people make assumptions about each other. And those assumptions become a shaky foundation for community, and then for decision-making processes that truly serve everyone. And so I if I could add sort of one hashtag, it would be talk to each other with a sense of openness and empathy. And there's a phrase that is often, we often use at Earth Justice, that the people closest to the problems are also closest to the solutions. And so having some humility about the fact that anyone who is the closest to the problem that you want to solve will know more about it than you ever will. And just having that humility to know that you don't know, even if you are well-intentioned.
Fabiana Rodriguez wrote an interesting essay that has to do with pop culture. And she brought up the fact that there isn't a real move in pop culture to let us think that it's glamorous to ride public transportation or that it's really trendy. All the really cool rock stars are eating plant-based diet. You know, that's sort of missing. What's in our, I started thinking more about the pop culture end of it. And I started thinking about all of the costume changes that we see in pop culture. And then I started thinking about the people who I know who have only 10 items in their closets, but they change them out every 2 months. And that means that somewhere in a landfill, there's a whole lot of clothes that have been worn like once or twice. And that's part of this problem. That's part of it's not, as you have pointed out many times in this conversation, it's not just climate. It's a web of how we live that is wasteful and toxic. And that humility that you've just talked about has to do with recognizing where we are wasting. I am embarrassed to point out that I'm talking to you on this very important topic and sipping from a plastic. I mean, we're just not always really conscious about little things that we're doing that have an impact. So it seems like looking at some of those, just looking at ourselves in the mirror is part of that humility.
I think so. I resist. I do think we have to change. And I don't think it's going to be this sort of perfect. You'll never notice anything happened. It just all went electric and it was better. I think we're past that point. But I think there's this kind of toxic narrative about you'll have to sacrifice everything. And the fun times are over. And it's your fault for having that plastic cup. And I do think we all bear some responsibility. But I think the responsibility that we bear is to examine our lives a little bit and think, is this the best way to live? What are we missing here? And why am I overconsume? Or, you know, as James Baldwin recognized, like, why are people so over-medicated? And, you know, what is it? And I believe that the more that we are living in right relationship, in balance, the less we'll feel on our bones that this thing's going to come crashing down. And so whatever it is that can make us feel connected toward building a future that seems plausible, joyful, full of connection, not perfect, it never will be, but if we can involve ourselves in that way, I think that's it. I think the pop culture that would save us is one that's like invested in this incredible place and in the power of humans to change. And I'm seeing more and more of it. I think the people who are coming into leadership now, the young people who are leading the Sunrise Movement, you know, I think they are very glamorous in their ambition.
A couple of years ago, I was in Poland, and it was the middle of winter, and the air was really bad. It was very thick, it was very gray, and it smelled awful. And I asked a little bit about that, and I was told that people were still burning trash to heat their homes. And at first that surprised me, and I started kind of looking around to see what was going on. And they were just then starting to implement a plan That was 2015. And in the next 5 years, their plan was just being laid out to improve all of that and to change that practice. So we know that there are examples around the world that that can improve, but we know that ours can improve as well. What is it that we can give to other countries? What are we doing well in the U.S. that we can use to share with others?
We have a great legal system, if we can hold on to it. And I'm serious. I know that's my thing, but it's astonishing what happens to an ambition and reliability of government if you have real people be able to contribute to enforcing the law. That's one thing that we should be exporting. And I will say that whenever we work abroad, I think there's a direct correlation between environmental protection and the strength of environmental review. So having that framework in place would be a terrific export plan. I think we're doing really exciting work. We've had a tough 4 years for government investment in research and development, but for decades, you know, our National Renewable Energy Lab, our Department of Energy, these are incredible institutions with incredible people within them. So all the work that's being done now to get us on a swift transition from fossil fuels, get to sustainable agriculture. I mean, that's scientific knowledge. And then just wealth, you know, the kind of green financing that's required and being able to be a catalyst for private sector investment. The U.S. is in an unparalleled position to spur change. There's no wealthier country with more technological know-how, financial ability. I mean, not just wealth, but like our financial instruments, the sophistication of folks who know how to do these kinds of public-private partnerships. It's just extraordinary what we could do with a political will that said, this is an emergency on the scale of the Great Depression. It's bigger than that, but we're going to put everything into it. If we saw the Build Back Better vision that Biden-Harris campaigned upon come to life, and everyone should be paying attention to the American Jobs Plan, and don't be fooled, the infrastructure's plan is not enough. We need to see catalytic investments of the kind that we've never seen happen to jumpstart our own climate solutions. And then other people can watch us do it and follow that lead with our help. And if we don't do it, China will. You know, one of my favorite essays in the book is by Kendra Pierre-Louis, and it's called Wakanda Has No Suburbs, I think. I just want to make sure I'm getting that right. But I encourage everyone to read it. She talks about why is the dystopian story so much more popular? Why do we believe we inherently wreck the earth? Let's imagine a new story for ourselves and recognize it isn't inevitable that we're going to have to fly to Mars to survive, that we could take care of this incredible planet we live on and come out the other side better than we were. And it's a really cool, hard-hitting essay. It's not Pollyanna-ish in the least, but I agree with her. Let's imagine the other side of our natures and live into it.
Abigail Dillon, president of Earth Justice, who contributed an essay to the anthology All We Can Save. This book was recommended by Vicky Lorini. Our podcast is produced by Jen Picard. Our recording and technical team included Toshina Brito, James Tejada, Antonio Muniz, and Mark Jones. The executive producer is Joe Barr. Our theme song is from Pond 5. You can find more information about the authors and books at capradio.org/reads or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Donna Epidone. Thanks for listening to Cap Radio Reads from Capital Public Radio.